Trust you, as you came in, you got the sheet there that you have, and okay, good job. And Numbers is where we're at this evening, and we'll be looking at this book, the fourth of the Pentateuch, or the Law of Moses, and we'll talk here in a second, why does it get the title of Numbers, and the like of that. Look at this book of Numbers, and for us, the information is already given to you on the sheet of who wrote this, because by this point, hopefully you know who's written these books that are the first five, and that would be Moses that wrote the book of Numbers. And for you reading through this, and it is good for us to understand what this is covering, this book is covering suddenly and speedily after chapter 9 about 38 years of time. From Exodus chapter 19 to Numbers chapter 9 is about a year of material. That's something that people don't realize, is that's what it's covering. It's covering a year of time that the nation of Israel sits at Sinai, they construct the temple, they get the priesthood set up, they get all of these things taken care of. They're there for a year, and it covers from Exodus 19 to Numbers chapter 9. And then all of a sudden, you have this full history of the nation of Israel going all the way to chapter 25, covering 38 years of time. A little bit more than that, but that's all it covers. And you're suddenly going, we go in all this time in these different books, and it's just a single year of time, and then all of a sudden we have all these events that take place, and it's covering a time span. And so for us, getting that kind of grasp of the book of Numbers, you realize that we don't have every story in the adventure of wandering 38 years. Okay, we have the highlights, or we might say the lowlights, of their wandering for 38 years that they ended up doing. We have that in this book, and so you look at the book and you find out that it's probably good to just think of the theme as this, is wandering rebellion. You go, why is it rebellion? Well, they're told certain things by God. This is what you're going to do. And they don't like it. They don't like what God's told them. They don't like God's leadership. They don't like the food they've been given from the table of heaven. Don't like any of those things. And so they spend 38 years wandering because they're a rebellious people. They're a stiff-necked people. And they just will not change. And so you get that really as a theme for this book. You say, when is it written? Written for Israelites waiting to enter the promised land. When was it written? At the end of the wilderness wanderings. Once again, you have people that are waiting to enter the promised land, and some of them would have not been familiar with some of these events because they weren't alive at the time that these events took place. But yet they're waiting to go into the promised land that God had promised to Abraham. You say, what's this? What's the arrangement of the book? Arrangement of the book works this way. You have the first generation's march in the wilderness, chapters 1 to 25, and you go, what do you mean by the first generation's marching in the wilderness? These are the ones who came out of Egypt, 20 and above, that experienced all the events of the wilderness wandering. Granted, there were people under the age of 20 that experienced this, but that what we mean by the first generation is that by the time we're done with chapter 25, most of the people are dead that had rebelled. God had scattered their body across the wilderness. And that's kind of the theme that you have in the middle of this book, that God just does this. He takes their bodies and it's scattered around. And you could have followed where Israel was at by all the grave markings that you would have had alongside the road and alongside the desert path that they were on. And so this is the first generation's march in the wilderness, and what you have in Numbers chapter 1 through 9 is numbering. Say, where and why does the book of Numbers get its name? It's because as you start off the book, you begin to realize, okay, here's who's going to be the leaders of all the tribes, and let's count off the tribes. See how many each one of them have that are 20 years and older. You go, well, why is that important? Because if you were 20 years and over and a male, you would be expected to fight. And so they were trying to get a head count of who would be available if they ever went to war. And they're going to go to the promised land. They're going to go to war eventually. So you have this numbering that takes place. It covers a chapter or two. You also see a lengthy counting of the Levites. And it's laid out for the Levites what each one of them is going to do, what they're going to carry when they move, what their responsibilities in moving around are going to be, and lays that out for them. Besides the numbering of the people, you also have an arrangement of the camp that's given. Okay, after the numbers are counted, then there is the fact that there are going to be three tribes to the east of the tabernacle. There's going to be three tribes to the north, three tribes to the south, and three tribes to the west, and they're always going to be there, and there's going to be one tribe in those three that's going to be the center tribe, and that this is the way that you're going to move 2 million people around. I've thought about that. You know, you think about field trips that you may have taken with kids and whatever else and trying to get them where they're supposed to be going and that and making sure they've got everything and that, and you finally get them going, and, you know, it's just, you don't know where they're going to wander off to. Well, this was God's way of trying to organize them and go, okay, we're going to have banners over the camp. Now, you're going to have banners to identify where certain groups of people are supposed to be at, and when you hear trumpet blasts, you hear one trumpet blast, two trumpet blasts, three trumpet blasts, four trumpet blasts, you go, what does that mean? Well, you're moving first. Your group's moving a certain direction, and you're going to end up in a way leading out. And so God is just organizing these people, giving them structure, and saying, okay, you need to be prepared to get into the promised land. So you have one numbering, but there's going to be a second numbering. Okay, and we'll talk about that. That's why the book is titled Numbers, not just number. It's Numbers. Chapters 10 to 12, you say Sinai to Kadesh Barnea. I believe that Sinai is located over in Saudi Arabia. That's where Midian is at, and that's where they were located. And so over in northern, what we would say, Arabia, Saudi Arabia today, and coming back and going to Kadesh Barnea, which is just on the southern border of what we know as the nation of Israel today. In that track, as you go from chapter 10 to chapter 12, there are different things that go on. You have people that rebel against Moses in the sense that they are unhappy, that they complain in verse 1 of chapter 11, and they complain about certain things, and there's a fire that starts outside the camp. God does some judging like he did the judging of Nadab and Abihu. It seems like some of these people were consumed by fire that complained. And then in verse 4 of chapter 11, you have this mixed multitude. And you say, who's the mixed multitude? The mixed multitude were people who were not Israelites. It wasn't just Israelites wandering around in the wilderness. It would have been people that came out in the Exodus that were disaffected Egyptians that didn't like being in Egypt. It would have been people who were slaves of other nationalities, people that were there as slaves, and when the slaves were freed, they just said, we're leaving too, and they go their way with the nation of Israel. And you see that these people, the mixed multitude, caused problems. They're making a stir that they loved in verse number 5. We remember the fish which we did eat in Egypt freely. Really, how quickly we forget what our past is. It's not a new thing in the culture of mankind. But we did eat in Egypt freely the cucumbers, the melons, the leeks, the onions, and the garlic. And I'm sitting there going, that's a way to... a reason to run away, in some ways, all those things. But now our soul is dried away. There's nothing at all besides this manna before our eyes. The food of angels. Yeah, well, you know, all those things in Egypt, they were really fantastic, but the stuff from God, I don't like it. And so you have the starting of the rebellion, the dislike of what God's given, the freedoms that he's given. They don't like it. You have in chapter 12, even Moses' family rising up against him. You have that famous verse of saying that Moses was the meekest man upon the whole earth in verse 3 of chapter 12. His own brother and sister are saying, we don't like what you have done. We don't like your wife. We don't think that, you know, you should have married her and all of this. And so God has to straighten out both Aaron and Miriam. And it's at that point that we, with all of that chaos that's seemingly starting up, that you're just going, this is not going to go well. And it doesn't go well because the pivotal chapter in Numbers is the one, or the two that are there in Numbers chapter 13 through 25. It's basically the failure of the nation to have faith in God. And chapter 13 and 14 is the 12 spies and unbelief. You know, 12 men went to spy in Canaan, 10 were bad and 2 were good. You know, you got that song that you're familiar with. But really, there's a serious, you know, that's kind of a casual and light song, but what goes on here is that these people are standing on the border of the promised land, the easy border, because 38 years later, they're going to take the tough border and cross over the river to come into the land with 2 million people. But here they are waiting. They send in 12 spies. They go through the land for 40 days. They see all the good things that are going on there. They go through in the month of June and July, as far as we can tell, because they're gathering grapes and the first ripe grapes that are there. And they go through the land, and they come back, and Joshua and Caleb are going, this is a great land. And you can see some of the blessing that this land flows with milk and honey. And understand that idea of honey is not just merely talking about stuff that bees make. Okay, it's talking about the fruits that are there that you can get SERPs from and this type of thing, the sweets that are there. And they show all of this off, but the other 10 spies that are there come back and go, yeah, this is all there, but there's a problem. Really big people are there, and they're really mighty and strong, and we'd be like little grasshoppers just jumping at their feet and that, a nuisance. We wouldn't be able to do anything to them. And Joshua and Caleb come back and are arguing for the fact this is the land God's given to us. And you have the whole nation ready to stone Moses and Joshua and Caleb. That's what they bring them out to do. And God says, okay, fine. In fact, he wants to come, and as you read the story, there is a frustration of Moses. There is a frustration of God with his people. And God says, fine. I was the one who delivered you from Egypt. 10 mighty plagues against the mightiest nation in the world at the time. I marched you through the Red Sea. Do you not have a little bit of faith, like the grain of a mustard seed, to just trust me to get you into this country and take care of things in front of you? And the nation says, no, we don't want to do that. And he says, fine. Those of you that didn't want to go, all of you, because you rebelled against Moses and Joshua and Caleb because you wanted to stone and kill them, all of you over the age of 20 are not going to enter the promised land. You're going to start wandering the wilderness, and you're going to do this for 40 years. Why 40 years? Because the spies were in the land 40 days. One day matches 1 year, and you're going to experience that kind of thing for 40 years, and your carcasses are going to lie in the wilderness. Well, it's at that point where people go, we don't like those consequences. We're going to go in and invade the land. And so they have this presumptuousness where they go into the land, and they immediately get beat up, just like they said they would if they were trusting in their own strength, which is they were at that point saying, we can do this. And it starts Well, everything that goes on. And so as you read through Numbers, you begin to see a pattern here as you go through, because here you have this unbelief. God says you're going to wander the wilderness, and after that, in the reading of your book, you get some laws and some rules. God says, okay, I'm going to make it clear some of the things that I'm expecting. Okay, you failed here, so this is how it oftentimes happens with us, with dealing with children. There's a failure to do something, and so you lay out the law, you lay out some rules. Well, you have this as you read through it. Chapter 15, there's all these different rules about different offerings and offerings for sin and ignorance, and even somebody who doesn't think that God's all that important and decides to go and do work on the Sabbath day intentionally, openly declaring this, and they as a nation stone that individual. God says, this is what you must do. My Sabbath day is a holy day. So you have that story. You get to chapter 16, second pivotal chapter in the book. This is the story of Korah and Dathan and Abiram. They're different tribes people, but you have Korah, who's one of the Levites. In fact, you get later on the Psalms, and you have the sons of Korah. These are individuals who are supposed to be leading the praise of God. But Korah and family members like that decided that they didn't like the leadership of Moses. You know, you brought us to the middle of this wilderness. You're the reason we're just kind of wandering around aimlessly. It's your fault. You don't know what you're doing. Who made you the ruler? Moses says, okay, what's going to happen is this. All of you that are rebelling right now, you come out and you gather your censers that you can hold fire in, and we all come before the tabernacle and we'll see what happens. And he tries to persuade them, he tries to talk to them. They are set in their rebellion against Moses, and so Moses finally says, okay, everybody understand this. You want to get away from these men. Don't stand around their living quarters. Don't stand around where they're at. Don't be anywhere near where they're at, because I'm going to, and this is what he's stating to God, that God is going to do something in an unusual way to show that these men are just dying a regular kind of death. They're going to die an unusual kind of death. And of course, what happens is, one of the most frightening experiences that people can ever have is that the solidity of the ground underneath their feet is suddenly gone and they're swallowed up by the earth. Their families, their tents, their possessions, and you see everybody just run. I mean, the story is they kind of stand off, and then when this happens, everybody runs home to their own tent to get away as far as they can from the ground swallowing them up. And you go, well, another story of their rebellion. And the answer is, yeah, that's another story of their rebellion. They don't like the leader God's given to them. And so you have instructions in chapter 17 through 19, more rules and laws that are laid out and instructions. Aaron's rod shows his power that God has given to him is put into the Ark of the Covenant, this rod that budded. All of these things, the priests and the Levites are given more instructions. You go, why priests and Levites? Korah is a Levite. Okay, part of the priestly clan, some of these individuals. And he's going, okay, you didn't understand some of the responsibilities you have. Let me lay them out more clearly for you. And so you have more instructions. Chapters 20 and 21, you begin to realize that this failure is one across the board. People complain they don't have water. And I think most of us kind of feel like Moses sometimes feels. You know, repeatedly, over and over and over again, these people have rebelled and called them all sorts of names and have said, you sought this power out, and they knew the story. Moses didn't seek this power out. In fact, he tried to get out of it as best he could, and God said, no, you can't. And he finally is in a situation where the people are complaining that there's no water, and God says, okay, I want you to speak to the rock. And he's already done this once in the history of the nation of Israel where this has happened, where water has come from an unusual source. Well, he decides that in his anger and frustration, he's going to teach everybody a lesson. So he takes the rod that's in his hand and strikes the stone twice, which is not what God told him to do. But in his anger, he did that. It kind of ruined the picture. You go, why is that? That's a picture of the life-giving ability of Christ, and he was only struck once to give life. But that's not what they immediately understood from this story. Moses is told he will not enter the promised land. And then you have the fact that Aaron dies. You have the story of the brazen serpent where these people are complaining again, and in the midst of the camp, these snakes come, and Moses has to lift up the serpent in the wilderness, takes a, like the banners in all the camps, he takes this snake and he puts it up on a high stick. Okay, and understand this, it probably wasn't, you know, a stick that was about 5 feet high and had the snake that was on there. This thing was lifted up. You got a camp of 2 million people. They got to be able to see this. And it's either he went up on the top of the mountainside or he just, where they were at, which would have been flat ground, he sticks this thing and whoever looks will live. Takes a little bit of faith on their part to do this, and they're thinking, no, that's not really going to work. But he says, you look, you'll live. And there were many that did not bother to look. And what happened to them? They died. They weren't willing to take the simple solution God offered to them. It just continues to show their rebellion in heart, their lack of faith. And so you have that whole account, and then it finally closes off on the last occasion in chapters 22 through 25. And this is one of the stranger sections in the Scripture. You have this one who are not sure what his background is, but is a prophet of some kind that is paid by different individuals to go and curse the nation of Israel. And of course, he goes to curse the nation of Israel, and his donkey is smarter than he is. This is one of those things I hope the Lord allows us to see when we get to heaven. You know, there are times where I'm just like, you know, there are certain scenes in the Bible I hope that are on video record for us to watch. There are certain elements that we hope we don't have to see, but this is one of them. Balaam is so angry, so angry that he keeps getting bumped off of his donkey, that he finally yells at this donkey and starts having a conversation that seems to be normal to him. And the donkey's talking back and forth with him and basically saying, haven't I been a good donkey? Well, yes, you have, but what's your problem now? You know, and this is the whole conversation, which, you know, most of us that have animals talk to our animals and they've never said anything comprehensible back to us, but I want to see this. You know, I want to see this occasion where the animal actually talked in a common language and communicated what was really on its mind. But then you get into the story and Balaam is, doesn't go to curse God's people, but then he does go to curse God's people, and he attempts to do it on four different occasions. Tells them, I can't do this, and they say, well, go ahead and do it. We'll move you to a good location. You can see the whole of the nation of Israel, and you can curse them. And he gets up there, and he says all sorts of wonderful things about God and the people of God. And so they thought, well, maybe it wasn't a good location. He just kind of misunderstood the instructions. Let's move you to a different location and have you do the same thing. And he says that over and over again. Finally, what you find in the story is that Balaam realizes that cursing God won't work, but he knows the sinful nature of the Israelites. And he says, well, here's what you do. Have a big old feast on the other side of the hill from where the nation of Israel is and invite them to come over. Because realize the people on the eastern side of the river where the nation of Israel is at are not the Canaanites that were supposed to be wiped out. Many of them are family members of Abraham, the Moabites, the Ammonites, which are Lot's descendants, the Edomites, which were Isaac's descendants. I mean, these aren't people that the nation of Israel is supposed to be wiping out, so they're trying to be okay with these individuals because they're kind of family and that. But all these family members are afraid of the nation of Israel, and the instructions for the king of Moab is this: you just have a big old festival on the other side where you worship your gods and whatever and invite the nation of Israel to come over, and they will. And sure enough, this is what you have, that these people go over the hill to celebrate the other gods that are there and the festivities, which would have been, in many cases, completely immoral. In fact, they bring the immorality back to the camp. And it just shows, here are these people in Exodus chapter 32 who all of a sudden worship this golden calf, and they rise up to play and all of this type of thing that goes along with false worship. They're still doing it in Numbers chapter 25. And you're going, did these people not learn from the first occasion God was really upset with them, and they're still doing this years later? And so you just have this whole thing where you really don't have fantastic stories other than Balaam is saying wonderful things about God. The nation of Israel just wanders in its rebellion, and so you get to the point where the nation of Israel is suddenly standing outside the promised land, and you have the second generations preparing to enter the promised land. You have another generation where you're kind of going, okay, maybe there's a chance that this group of people will follow God and love him and serve him and do this and call him their God as they see him do great things for them. And with the setting up there, you have the preparation for organization and conquest. You have the second numbering. You go, why is that? Well, here we're at the end of the 40 years, and you're getting ready to enter the promised land, and what are you going to be doing? You're going to be fighting battles, so you need to number those that are 20 and above males that are going to be ones called upon to go and fight. And so you have a second numbering. But this is a numbering of people that are ready now to enter the promised land, not, sadly, about to enter into wandering for a number of years. And so you have that numbering, and then as you read through chapters 28 through 36, you start getting instructions for these people as they're going to enter the promised land. Here's some of the things that you need to be familiar with as you're about to go into this land, that you're going to go in there and there's going to be buildings there that you haven't built and vineyards that you haven't worked on, and animals that you haven't done anything to raise up, and hey, you're going to have this. Well, how should you react to this? What is this going to be like, and how should you respond, and what should you do with these things? And so at the end of Numbers, you have this. Now, Deuteronomy is going to be a little bit different, because you're going to say, well, Deuteronomy is kind of Moses' last message. It's actually a series of messages that are set up in treaty form where he's going to give instructions finally to the nation of Israel and give them their charge before he dies. He goes up and sees the promised land and then dies. That's what Deuteronomy is going to be like, but it's a series of sermons. It's not instructions. It's kind of Moses giving a recounting of everything that he's learned over his 120 years that God has challenged him with and that he's seen God do with his own people. So continual themes, I think these two are pretty set in the book, is rebellion and failure and death. It just happens over and over again in this book, and you're going, but these are God's people. They aren't supposed to die. Well, they're sinning just like, sadly, everybody else is, and doing it in grand scale. And so you see these continual themes, just rebellion, failure to have faith, and death. It comes as a result of that. Repeated words, I will just say this, family. You say, where's that from? All the numberings. Over and over and over again, the family of family, the family of the family of the family of, and so you get this counting, thus the title of Numbers given in the book. Key verses, chapter 14, 26 to 34, this is the section where the Lord basically lays out what he's going to do to the people for 40 years. It's in the middle of the rebellion at Kadesh Barnea, and God just says, I'm going to lay this out, and I'm going to put your carcasses across the wilderness, and these babies that are amongst you are going to go in and conquer the promised land. You know, the nursery is going to do the conquering that you're supposed to be doing. They're going to do that. And God says that. There is one other passage. I did not put it down in your notes here, but it's one that is rather famous And it's not necessarily a key verse, but I would say it's actually a famous passage that you may have heard in different situations. And it is what is known as the priestly blessing. Numbers chapter 6, verse 23 to 27. Says this, speaking to Aaron and unto his sons, saying, on this wise ye shall bless the children of Israel, saying unto them, and here's the statement that you've probably heard before, the Lord bless thee and keep thee. The Lord make his face shine upon thee and be gracious unto thee. The Lord lift up his countenance upon thee and give thee peace. And they shall put my name upon the children of Israel, and I will bless them. But that statement, the Lord bless thee and keep thee, the Lord cause his face to shine upon thee. That's the priestly blessing that the priests were supposed to pray for this nation, that they would find peace, that they would find prosperity, calm, and the like. And that was something that was wished upon them. So that's a, not necessarily a key verse of the storyline, but it is a prominent verse that comes out of the book of Numbers. And so what do you have is this, just a one paragraph statement of what goes on here. The nation of Israel was organized for the successful invasion of the promised land. Okay, they're being organized to be successful. God's saying, this is, you know, I'm getting you prepared for this. Problem is their unbelief and subsequent rebellion caused them to miss the blessing of the promised land. They didn't enter, as the New Testament will describe in Hebrews, they didn't enter into the rest. Okay, they didn't enter into the rest that God had promised to them. They missed it. Thus, the next generation is given hope that they can succeed. Where the families have failed before them, that if they just trust God, they'll see deliverance and see this. And so Numbers is a transition book. It's designed to be that, to get you from the group from Egypt and all the things that they saw, now get the ones that are the new generation that are going to be the ones that conquer the promised land. And so, sadly, as you read through Numbers, I think we see ourselves sometimes reflected. You know, the way we are sometimes with our God, we see ourselves reflected in some of the attitudes that these people have to clear promises of God. And oftentimes we do the same thing. We read clear promises of God and say, well, you'll never do that. And really, is that the best you can do? I mean, that's sometimes what we think about God's promises. Is that really the best? And we kind of miss out on the fact that our God is infinite in wisdom and he's infinite in his goodness. And that if he says something, it's true. And if he says this is really a blessing, that it truly is. And in our flesh nature, we tend to look at it as we see it and how we feel about it rather than just taking God at his word and not rebelling. So that is the message of the book of Numbers. And we'll get to Deuteronomy next time. Lord, we thank you for being a gracious God to us. We see the nation of Israel in our own life. You've called us to be your people. And there are times where we cringe, hold back, don't trust. And that saddens you because you've done so much for us. The greatest of those is that you've saved us. And we still, living this life, don't look to you, have confidence in you. And we learn that that's something that is something that brings us under chastisement, punishment. If we continue in those paths, may we learn from the examples, as Paul called it in 1 Corinthians 10, that these stories were examples for us, examples to learn from, that we would learn not to tempt the Lord, that we would learn not to rebel and go after our own lusts, but that we would be people that look like your people, act like it, and have faith in you. So help us to learn from a book like Numbers and see your greatness, see our frailty, and have confidence in you. And this we pray in Jesus' name. Amen.